Okay, folks, let's get started. We're going to see now a series of talks regarding security. The first one, I'm very excited to introduce our keynote speaker, Raluca Adapopa, who is the Robert and Beverly Brooks Assistant Professor at UC Berkeley. She specializes in security, privacy, and applied cryptography. She is a Microsoft and Sloan Fellow. She holds an Intel Early Career Award and the Hellman Faculty Award. And she's very well known in particular for bringing homomorphic encryption into the practical realm with her CryptDB and Mylar systems, which have seen wide adoption in industry, including at Microsoft, Google, and other places. So it is my great pleasure to have her speak and honor to have her speak at our conference about security and privacy in the cloud.
Thank you, Roxana. Can you hear me well? Even in the back? Great. All right, so it's really nice to be here. It's such a nice crowd and a great place. So my talk will be about securing data in compromised clouds, which may sound a little bit contradictory, but it is still possible. So we hear in the news about massive data breaches all the time. Why don't they stop? Well, the reason is that the way we protect security today in the cloud is fundamentally insufficient. Okay? So clouds protect sensitive user data by building taller and taller walls around this data, such as firewalls, access control logic within an application, and so forth. Okay, but this software stack that we rely on to protect the data is complex and has bugs, right? And attackers manage to exploit bugs to get in and steal data. And we will always end up having bugs. So attackers will always manage to break in. So instead, we should just assume that attackers will eventually break in. It's just a matter of time, and be prepared even then. So I like this quote from Werner Vogels, the Amazon CTO, who says when thinking about the cloud that basically applications need to protect themselves instead of relying on firewall-like techniques. So you should still rely on the cloud security, should still be used, but that shouldn't be the only thing that you rely on. The application should also protect themselves inside the cloud. So one way to protect data is obviously encryption. And you've probably heard already that industry uses encryption all over the place. However, they use it in an insufficient way. Okay, so the way you use the encryption really, really matters whether encryption is effective or not. So here are two paradigms in which industry uses encryption today that are not quite sufficient. They're very useful, but not sufficient. For example, when a user wants to send a file to the cloud, well, then she's going to use a secure communication via SSL, via TLS and SSL. And so attackers on the network cannot see the data, but as soon as the data reaches the cloud will be able to decrypt it. Okay? So this is encryption in transit, and it's widely used, and it's very, very effective. But the point is that the data is decrypted when it reaches the cloud. Another form of encryption that is widely used in industry is encryption at rest. So the data is encrypted in storage, but the keys are at the cloud. So as soon as the data needs to be processed, it's going to be decrypted. And then if you send the data back, you have again encryption at rest, encryption in transit. Okay? So the problem we have here is that the data is exposed for the duration of the processing, in particular for this part of the life cycle, and this is where the attacker can steal it from. And in fact, a lot of the data breaches you hear about is an attacker stealing the data from the application by exploiting some bug. They're not stealing the disks, right? That's kind of an old, that was an old threat to steal some disks and run away with them. Instead, what's very, very effective is if you use encryption in an end-to-end way, okay? So using end-to-end encryption. So the idea is that the users have a key on their devices with which the data is decrypted, but the cloud never gets the key, okay? So as soon as the data leaves the user device, it's encrypted, and it's sent encrypted to the cloud. It stays encrypted in the cloud, and then sent back encrypted to the next user that it's shared with, who can decrypt it. Okay? And the user should only have keys for the data that they actually share and that they actually own access to. Okay? They wouldn't have keys for data that they're not given access to. Okay. So in this paradigm, it's very simple and very effective because if an attacker breaks in at any point in time, the data is encrypted. Okay. However, the problem is what happens to all those nice cloud computing systems we have in the cloud? How are they going to process the encrypted data? And so here I'm going to show you a spectrum in increasing complexity based on the computation that they perform of cloud systems. Again, this is rough. And then we're going to discuss how can these be enabled in the cloud with encrypted data. Okay. So one of the simplest applications is chat and messaging, because you just send data to the cloud and it mostly forwards it to the recipient. Then there's email and file sharing, which become more complicated because you have emails that you or files that you modify or files that you give access to someone or revoke access. And then we start having databases, right, where we start computing on the data and doing queries. And I'm going to separate OLTP from analytics just because, you know, in the first category, I'm looking at simple point queries that tend not to be very complicated. And the second one, analytics, we could have really complex queries over the data, computing statistics and correlations could be very complicated. And then an even more complex workload is machine learning. Okay? So the question is, how are we going to run all these systems with encrypted data? So this is a primary area of focus for me, and I've done research in this for almost 10 years now, over a decade. And slowly building up techniques for more and more and more computation and more security. So in this talk, I'm just going to give you highlights of this trajectory over time, where these systems went, techniques, research highlights, and where they are right now. Okay, so I won't go deep in any specific system, but I will try to give you a sense of the kind of techniques the systems use and some highlights and lessons we learned in this almost a decade. 8 years, more precisely. All right, so let's start with the first one. Chat and messaging. This really is the easiest. We already have pretty good solutions in industry that have been widely adopted. So WhatsApp uses end-to-end encryption. Many of you use WhatsApp, probably. Then we have Signal for group messaging and Keybase. Okay. So in terms of research, I would say that at least the base functionality is to a large extent solved, and you know you can use the systems easily. But there's a bunch of research, and even we did some research in extensions such as many-to-many communication, as in a publish and subscribe. We have a system called JEDI. Then how about constrained devices that can't use public key encryption and fancy operations? What happens there? And usability. Okay, but to a large extent, this area is, you know, I would say we have very good solutions in industry. All right, the second one is end-to-end encrypted email and file sharing. And here's more complex because you start having to add access to people, to files, revoke access, and edit documents. Okay, so now you have to worry about key distribution. And you have to do it in a way that does not disrupt usability. So you can't call up your friend and say, I need to give you a key. And then, or if you lose your device, you lost access to your key, so you lost access to your data, right? So the challenge is to still give usability. But even here, I feel that we have a number of good solutions as of today in industry. So ProtonMail is end-to-end encrypted email. Trezorit is a Swiss-based company that does end-to-end encryption for emails and file sharing. And my own company, Prevail, does end-to-end encryption for file sharing and for emails for both enterprises and users. Very easy to use. There's still some research that's being focused on really going at the next level. What if these cloud providers were really malicious and try to change documents and things like this? So how do you provide protection against cloud attackers? And we have some work in that space with Verena. And then there's works on, again, usability. What if someone loses their key and devices, and how are they going to retrieve their data? And I would say another big problem that's left in this space is how do you search, right? If the data is encrypted, how do you search? And this actually brings us to, search brings us to the next category, which is database queries, because essentially they search, right? And here we're gonna look at simple queries first, such as insert, delete, select based on filter, and so forth. Okay, so how can we do that with encrypted data? So this vision of computing on encrypted data existed for a while. So in 78, Rivest, Adelman, and Dertouzos proposed it. And in 2009, Craig Gentry proposed the first construction, but that was, and it still is too theoretical to use. But the paradigm goes like this. You have a user that has a key, and she encrypts the data that she puts on the cloud. Okay. Then, whenever she wants to query this data, she sends the function f. So every query is a function. With computation on encrypted data, the cloud should be able to process encrypted data without decrypting it and compute the function on the encrypted data. So basically, at the end of it, you get the encryption of the function of the data. And then it can send that back to the user who can decrypt it and get the actual function result. So this might sound quite magical. How does that actually work? And so I like to give people one very simple example to help build some intuition. So the Paia crypto system enables you to do computation on encrypted data, but for addition. Okay, you can only do the function equals addition. So the way encryption looks in Paia is that you have the encryption of x is g to the x, as you can see, times some randomness modulo n. So this g is a big cryptographic number, and the idea is that when you raise it to the power of x and you do modulo n squared, no one can retrieve x. Okay, that's cryptographic hardness assumptions. Encryption of y is the same, just g to the y and a different randomness. So now consider that the cloud has both of these encryptions, and we tell the cloud, hey, do summation for me. The cloud cannot see what x and y are, they're encrypted, but it can multiply these ciphertexts. And when it multiplies, look what happens. You get the g to the x plus y, right? Because g to the x times g to the y is g to the x plus y. And then the randomness groups together to the power of n, okay? And then modulo n squared. And that is encryption of x plus y. Okay? So basically, the encryption algorithm has this property that if you multiply two ciphertexts, then you get an encryption of the sum of the values. And like this, there is a bunch of other encryption algorithms that can support even more complex functions. In fact, fully homomorphic encryption can support arbitrary functions. The problem, though, is that even though there's been tremendous progress, really a lot of beautiful work in the past 10 years on this, it's still orders of magnitude too slow, okay? It depends a lot on what use case you have, but I would say at least 4 orders of magnitude too slow on many, many different workloads. So how can we build practical systems? And a lot of my work has been in building practical systems, and the key insight is to co-design systems and cryptography, okay? So we're gonna start with the system workload, and understand what kind of operations you need, core operations you need to support it. And then you make sure you employ cryptographic schemes that are specific to those operations, so are targeted and fast to those operations. And then you go back to the system setting and you build planners and compilers that can combine them together and make them work together in an efficient way. So within this approach, the first system that I designed was CryptDB in 2011. EncryptDB was the first DBMS to process SQL queries on encrypted data. At a high level, the way it worked is that, so you had the data encrypted in a database, and on some trusted place, let's say in premise or in hardware enclaves or wherever you want, you had a CryptDB proxy storing a key, okay? Here, the emphasis was to remove the database from the cloud from the trust perimeter, okay? So we're focusing on attacks to the database. So then whenever an application sends a query, the CryptDB proxy intercepts it and would transform and rewrite this query, encrypt some of the values in it, and then transform it to work with cryptographic operations, and then send that to the database, which can then execute the query on the data and produce some encrypted results that the proxy then decrypts and sends to the application. And there are a few really nice features of this layout. One was that you don't change the applications. You don't have to worry about your crazy encryption. And the other is that we actually even managed to not change the DBMS, which really helped a lot with deployment. And the reason we didn't change the DBMS was that we cast encryption operations in terms of regular operations or in terms of user-defined functions. OK, but the question is, all right, how did we actually do that computation on encrypted data? And I would say these were the core techniques that then we managed to generalize in techniques that we used over and over for different systems. So the main observation was that most SQL can be implemented with a few core operations, right? Plus, equals, greater than. Then the first technique was to employ an efficient encryption scheme for each operation. And because it's targeted at that operation, it's efficient. So remember the Paillet encryption scheme, which could do addition, right? You just had to do multiplication instead of addition. So that's not too bad. And in some cases, if there wasn't such an encryption scheme, you had to design your own. So we designed a number of such encryption schemes for join or comparison and so forth. Then another technique was, OK, how do you combine them? They have different constraints in terms of security and functionality. So we came up with this mechanism called onion encryption, in which we stack them depending on their security and functionality. And the third technique was to basically now redesign the query planner so that it thinks in terms of encrypted queries and in terms of encrypted operations. And some operations are not compatible with each other. So the planning rules change a lot. So it was really fun to kind of think of how to redesign the planner to work with cryptographic operations. Okay. And the outcome of that was that we could run all queries on TPCC with all data being encrypted with CryptDB, and the throughput loss was 27%. So this spurred a very rich line of work in the past 8 years with lots of academic work and systems, CypherBase, CMD, CryptSys, lots of them, more than 1,000 academic works, and a bunch of industry deployments as well. For example, Microsoft Always Encrypted, which is a part of the SQL Server, was inspired by this as well. So at the end of all these works, and I'll tell you what the works are doing today, I'll give you some summary of where we are. But at the end of these works, the lesson that we learned that persisted through time all the way till today, till the designs today, is basically a co-design of systems and cryptography with basically this recipe. So first, you kind of identify a workload, machine learning or data analytics. And then you identify the set of core operations that the system needs to support that workload. And then for each one of them, you identify a suitable encryption building block that's efficient for that operation. And then you have to work to create a planner or a compiler that can combine the encryption building blocks based on their constraints and costs. And for the architecture, to avoid changing the existing applications and cloud systems as much as possible. So this was the first lesson that we learned just looking back, you know, over the past 8 years. This has been something that we've been applying, and other researchers have been applying over and over again in designing this kind of crypto systems. Another lesson we learned is that it's actually quite difficult to identify a suitable encryption building block efficient for each operation, because there is a very difficult trade-off in functionality, efficiency, and security. That's always the case with privacy. So first of all, the existing building blocks that are practical have very limited functionality. They could do complex analytics or machine. They couldn't do complex analytics and machine learning. They could do just very simple operations. And while those operations are technically Turing complete, you couldn't actually. They wouldn't work to actually nest them, so it's not Turing complete. Moreover, there is a really sharp trade-off between security and performance. And let me try to sketch this trade-off in a very rough way. So consider that you have this spectrum of privacy from no privacy. The cloud sees all the data, which is what happens today, all the way till the cloud learns nothing. And I'm going to choose two points. There are multiple points here, but two are particularly significant. One is semantic security, where the data is encrypted with regular encryption schemes. And the other is oblivious security. So oblivious security is something about side channels. What it says is that the cloud cannot see which memory addresses you're accessing even, okay? Which data items you're accessing, okay? Why? Well, consider that I have a database of diseases, cancer, flu, and so forth. Even if they're encrypted, the cloud won't be able to see what the content is, but it sees the frequency of accesses, okay? Can see how often cancer is, the encryption of cancer is accessed versus the encryption of flu is accessed. And just from knowing how frequent these diseases are, that's public information, can infer which is which. Okay, so even the fact that you see what the cloud is fetching, it's a side channel, but even the fact that you see what the user is fetching from the cloud and how many times it leaks information. Okay, even if that's encrypted. And so you might wonder, is this something I care about in practice or not? Well, it depends on what attacker you're considering. If you're considering an attacker that can watch on the server queries, then you should care about it. If you consider an attacker that just steals the data, then maybe semantic security is enough for you. The point is that we'd like to have this oblivious guarantee with practical performance. All right, but here's the problem. There's been a lot of work in, you know, schemes for computing on encrypted data, very rich literature, trying to produce practical schemes, and most of them are in this space. Right, they're managing to give you semantic security, but they're really having a hard time hiding access patterns. Okay, and there's a number of attacks showing that, okay, if you don't hide access patterns, this is what could happen. So we've done a bunch of work in this space as well, coming close to basically offering semantic security in our ARC system, as well as attacks showing that even from, you know, the volume of operations, you could learn something. Okay, so we'd really like to go all the way right, if we could, in a practical way. Well, we actually can go right, but not in the practical section, with oblivious algorithms. And these algorithms, like PathORM and so forth, are great. They basically hide what data you're fetching from the server. How? Well, you're kind of fetching a bunch of other items as well, and you're constantly re-randomizing the location of the data. And that's how they hide what you're fetching. So then the cloud can't keep track that you access the cancer record that many times versus the flu record that many times. But of course, this means you're making all these many more accesses. So that's been really a problem that for even up to today, actually, we don't have a scheme in that space. We don't. It's a question mark. And in fact, we do have lower bounds showing that you need to make at least, you know, need to fetch at least a certain number of items to give obliviousness. So kind of in a sense, the literature has been, you know, trying to kind of close the gap more and more, but still don't really have an answer. So if you're a cryptographer, then you take the lower bounds and you're kind of done, that's it. But if you're a systems person, then you can change the setting a little bit, right? So you can, okay, think about what else can you do? How can you change maybe the trust model or the setting and the parties involved to overcome the lower bounds? So there's been a lot of great work in that. So for example, one such directions is using hardware enclaves in combination with the cryptography. So hardware enclaves themselves have side channels, but the cryptography is really good at helping them avoid them. Okay, so we can have the best of both worlds. And the nice thing with hardware enclaves is that we can also get complex analytics on machine learning. The other thing is if you want to stay in the crypto realm, then if you have a multi-party computation across multiple parties that can interact, that interaction adds, avoids the lower bound and enables for complex algorithms to be executed with this strong level of security. So our system on Opaque provides, and I'll mention in a bit, provides data analytics, complex analytics using secure enclaves in an oblivious way. And Oblix provides point query style, so OLTP style queries with obliviousness. And Helen and Delphi are doing training for linear models and deep learning inference. Okay, so we could get really rich computation because we employ these other mechanisms. Okay. And then, okay. All right, so let's talk a little bit in a little bit more detail about how we do data analytics. How many people here know how hard Oran cliffs work? Can you raise your hand? Okay. A few, all right. So I'll give you a very quick 101. So hard Oran cliffs, like IntelliSGX, is a hardware-enforced isolation execution environment. Basically, this is the picture of simplified picture of your processor. And on the die, you have this extra encryption engine that encrypts all the data that goes out to memory and decrypts it when it comes back. So the data will be decrypted only on the die inside the processor, but it will be encrypted even in memory. So this is great because this is going to protect even against an attacker that has root access on your machine, like a compromised OS. And by the way, there are today cloud offerings of hard Oran cliffs that you can use, like Azure Confidential Computing, Microsoft has one, and Alibaba Cloud. Okay. The other nice thing that Enclave have is remote attestation. So you're a client and you want to run something at a cloud server that could have been compromised. And there's an Enclave there and you want to ship your code in there safely. So what you do is with remote attestation, you're going to send some code to the Enclave. And the Enclave has a mechanism to measure the code, basically produces a hash and signs the hash by the Enclave, whose key is signed by Intel and certified by Intel, and says, look, I certify that I'm running the code with this hash, and I'm an Enclave created by Intel. At that point, the client is happy and establishes a secure connection exchanging a key. Okay? And once it has a key exchanged with the Enclave, it can send encrypted data and all kinds of things. Okay. Now, one problem with Enclaves that you probably heard in the news is that they suffer from a lot of different side channels. So if you look carefully at all these side channels, you notice one thing, that they all reduce to exploiting which memory addresses are accessed. Okay, so the attacker sees which memory addresses are accessed and are doing attacks of the sort, let's say if the program says, if disease is cancer, access this and access this, then the attacker sees that this was accessed, hence disease is cancer. The only difference between these attacks is that they take this memory address information from different components, some from the cache, some from the branch predictor, you know, some from the page fault, page tables mechanism. Okay? But they all reduce to the attacker seeing memory addresses. Well, that's great because that can be prevented with oblivious computation. Okay? So again, oblivious algorithms hide they randomize what memory addresses are being accessed, or they always access them in a certain predefined order. So that's really great that because if you design an oblivious application and you put it inside SGX, you don't have to worry about these side channels. To some extent, I think it's even, you know, a lot to ask for the Enclave to take care of those side channels for you when you can take care of them yourself by building the application in an oblivious way. Okay, so basically we need oblivious computation with enclaves, but wait a minute, wasn't that slow? Right, so it seems like we're back to square one. But the really cool insight here is that there's a synergy between the crypto and the enclaves. The crypto in obliviousness is slow because there's a lot of interaction between the client and the server. But that's exactly what enclaves can help you with because you can put the client inside the server. Okay, so then you really avoid that costly part of the obliviousness by using enclaves. Okay, so essentially the enclave is speeding up the crypto and the crypto is helping the enclaves not suffer from these side channels. So within this insight, we built our system Opaque, which is an oblivious and encrypted distributed analytics platform. It basically runs Spark SQL. So if you've ever used Spark SQL, we can run Spark SQL in enclaves with obliviousness. So basically, what you get is that the cloud doesn't get to see your data and still runs analytics for you. So an attacker who compromises the cloud equally doesn't get to see your data. At a high level, the layout is something like this. You have a client that's going to send a job, like a query. First, it's going to plan the query into a DAG, execution DAG, that's encrypted and authenticated. And it's going to send it to the scheduler, which is then delegated to different enclaves. And enclaves are going to fetch encrypted data, are going to decrypt it inside, they're going to do a bunch of computation, exchange it with each other, and in the end obtain the result and send it back to the client who can decrypt. So inside OPAQ, there's a lot of different techniques that I'd like to refer you to the paper. But at the high level, what we do is basically, again, follow the same recipe as EncryptDB. The recipe is that we identified what operators do we care about in an analytic setting. We care about join, aggregations, filter. And we designed oblivious protocols for those, okay, that you can't extract memory, useful memory address information from. And then we're building a planner that understands these, understands how to compose them in a safe way, understands their cost models and how to plan an efficient plan. Okay? And you can see the paper for more details. So OPAQ is also open source if you want to play with it. It already has some adoption, including by IBM Rest Assured, which is an European medical project. They have a cool video of how they use it as well. Okay. So we've gotten a sense of how to do analytics. How about machine learning? And here, I'm mostly looking at collaborative machine learning. Here's what I mean by that. So one very relevant use case is money laundering detection. So banks want to detect money laundering using machine learning. Why? Because criminals conceal their illegal activities across many banks. So they would love to jointly compute a model on customer transaction data across the many banks, but they cannot share the data because they are competing with each other. So today, in many cases, they just don't compute this, which is too bad. So we have two approaches for addressing this problem. One is the Hardware-Runcliffe plus Oblivious algorithm combination, again, for the side channels. And the other is a direction in cryptography called secure multi-party computation, which is much more efficient than fully homomorphic encryption because the interaction between the parties really enables you to do much more. So let's take a look at each one of them briefly. What I want to say is that we wanted really hard to choose just one, but there is a trade-off between them. With the harder Runcliffe, you get much better performance and you can get to more complex algorithms, but then you need to trust the hardware and you need that kind of hardware. Although today we do have cloud offerings. And the second one, it's slower. It's going to be slower with the crypto, but you can start running it anytime because it's just software. But it does need to also be in an interactive manner. It can be run in a cloud, in one cloud instance. It can be run across different clouds or at least across different cloud regions or private clouds. Okay, so how do you do secure collaborative ML via enclaves? Well, you should kind of already imagine that based on what I told you. Basically, you start with a key management enclave. Each of these parties is going to do a remote attestation, so making sure that this enclave is really running the code they want to run, like the money laundering detection code. And after they do this attestation between each user and enclave, the user sends one key, okay? And then this enclave can remote attest other worker enclaves, make sure, okay, these enclaves are going to run the correct code for this computation, okay, and prepare them for the computation. Now, the users can just send their data encrypted under their respective keys, and the enclaves are able to ingest them and decrypt them because they have the keys from the setup phase. Okay? And the whole idea is that we're running oblivious algorithms inside the worker enclaves as well to prevent all these side channels. So the last approach is using cryptography, and this is based on the MPC paradigm, which is a paradigm that says that, okay, with cryptography, you can simulate a trusted party. So what you're going to do is you're going to have a lot of interaction between these parties as they compute, and no party gets to learn each other's data. They only get to learn the final result. But again, the problem there is that whenever you use a generic scheme like this, it takes a really long time. It's very inefficient. So for example, we try training linear models on a simple representative data set, and it takes 3 months. Okay, we actually ran out of memory soon before that, but it's easy to estimate with crypto because it's so regular. But instead, what we did is we did the co-design of systems and crypto for the ML framework, and we managed to reduce the overhead to less than 3 hours. Okay, so this is for training linear models. And we also have some recent work, Delphi, that's doing secure inference for neural networks. Okay, so again, via the same mechanism of co-designing crypto and systems. All right, so one of the last few slides. So where are we headed? So we're very, very excited about the idea of building a very easy-to-use, secure collaborative learning platform for the non-expert. Okay, so anyone should be able to show up with some basic coding experience and write in a Python DSL a learning task or an analytics task, and we automatically compile it to secure computation, either via enclaves and obliviousness or via MPC. So we're building all of this in open source. It's already open source, it's new. So the one thing that we pushed there so far is secure collaborative training for decision trees, because that's what we're actually using in our collaboration with Scotiabank and Azure Confidential to do money laundering detection. But we are, in the next month, actually, we're pushing the secure inference for neural networks and a bigger planner that is able to ingest the Python DSL and convert it to secure computation. And we're generally looking for collaborations in this space and to try to achieve this bigger vision. And I'm very excited about this vision because it has a lot of potential for social impact, because without being able to share this data in a secure way, banks are not going to share it, so they're missing opportunities on detecting money laundering, fraud, human trafficking, or for medical research, they're missing opportunities in better medical studies. All right, so I gave you a tour de force in how the high-level techniques that go into running this kind of systems in the cloud while processing encrypted data. And the key takeaways I'd like you to leave with from this talk is, first, to assume that attackers will eventually break into any cloud. And you should be prepared even then. So you should be processing data in encrypted form. And the way to do this practically is to do a co-design of systems and cryptography. And this is one of the recipes that has worked a lot over and over again in the literature for designing some of these systems. That being said, any one of these points is difficult to accomplish. You need to do research or you need to do work on it. But still, this framework has worked really well. All right. Thank you very much. And I'm happy to take questions.
In one of your slides, you mentioned 27% overhead of doing encrypted queries. Is that for the simple queries or the range queries?
So in that case, it was 27% overhead throughput as compared to vanilla MySQL for the TPCC benchmark.
But that, does that include the range queries as well?
Yes, TPCC benchmark has range queries as well as, as well as point queries, as well as inserts and deletes.
Yeah, I think just one piece of information I wanted to share. There's a startup in Silicon Valley. It's a company called Baffle. Mm-hmm. So they're using MPC mm-hmm. on top of Postgres, DB2, and Oracle with 10% overhead. Actually. Mm-hmm. So they are able to do the encrypted queries on that.
That's great. That's exciting. I will take a look into that. I'm a little bit suspicious. MPC 10% overhead sounds challenging.
Hi, Professor. I'm Ming Xun from Peking University. Thank you for your talk. It's very interesting. And I have a question. Are there any algorithms for string matching in encrypted data? I believe that's very important. And because the traditional way to string matching is by constructing some tree structures. So it's not possible in encrypted data. So I wonder if there are any algorithms?
Yeah, that's a great question. String matching is quite difficult because you have a complex circuit. So you can do it with enclaves and obliviousness. There are oblivious libraries for string matching. So then if you run that with enclaves, then that's one way to do secure computation for string matching. If you are looking at secure multi-party computation for string matching, I imagine regular expressions and things like this will be pretty slow. will be pretty, pretty slow. Moreover, you will have to run in the worst case performance. So, you know, some regular expressions could actually blow up more than others. So I don't know of any efficient papers, but there are some attempts at that. Simple equality checks, or equality checks with wildcards, simple things like this. But full-blown regular expressions for a string matching is still an open question how to do efficiently.
Hi, Rilke, great talk. I appreciated a lot of the insight there. One of the things that is both cool but also challenging about your work is how you're using these different cryptographic mechanisms and composing them together. One of the things that seems challenging about that, though, is that each of these often come with sort of different security guarantees. And so I wonder, like, what your insights are about how to think about the overall end-to-end security guarantee when you put all these things together.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think that the easiest way to think is if you actually make them come together with the same security guarantee. So in the last works in the past few years, we've managed to do that. So for example, the MPC style work with the secure learning, we're composing all building blocks, they all have the same guarantee. You know, they take data from the from the different parties, they compute in MPC, the output remains encrypted, there's no leakage whatsoever until after you're done composing them, at the end you really reveal. So that's one thing. With enclaves, it's the same thing, it's uniform security all over. So yeah, I agree, the easiest thing you can do is to make sure they have the same security level. Yeah.
Hi, thank you so much for the talk. I love how rigorous and practical the work is. So one of the questions is around machine learning. For what I understand, is a collection of new classes of attacks around sort of data poisoning versus the model inversions, and like how are those combining, or you know, are some of these techniques can be helped for those, or they're kind of orthogonal?
Yeah, great question. So just to basically bring up the audience on the same level, so poisoning attack is when you have multiple parties like this that are learning on encrypted data, one of them could be putting bad data in, and you might not know when you see the final model is actually poisoned, and you don't know. Maybe the smart car model, when it sees the bridge, it just jumps off the bridge, right? And then there's the other question of, okay, once you computed the model, how much is the model leaking about the data? That's the model inversion attack. So they compose actually quite well with this, because we're trying to design a generic MPC framework where you write in a Python DSL what you want from it. So for example, in this system, we're also having policies. Like for example, let's validate the data someone puts in, right? So you can remove someone's data and train the model with the data and without, and see how the, you know, testing accuracy compares. Or we're not specifying any specific technique, but since it's a Python DSL, you can write any one of these, you know, validation mechanisms or policies that you want. And the same thing for releasing the model. You can add in differential privacy to it, or you can even have mechanisms that, there are some papers that check if a model remembers too much, and you could run that before releasing the model. So the point is that we're kind of complementary to all those mechanisms, but we're trying to ensure that we can express them, right? And then you choose what poisoning detection you want or what privacy and release policies you want and express them in our Python framework. And we're trying to provide some libraries for common ones as well.
Thank you.
Sure. Rusty from Apple. So we have, these are similar ideas kind of operating, you know, at scale for a lot of our, you know, various products. But I was wondering if you know of any work kind of looking at operability issues that show up with this. So there's the obvious, what happens if you lose all the copies of your key, but there's other things that are more subtle, like, you know, there's some data integrity problem, like, can the device detect it? Can we detect that we're losing rights? Like, there's all sorts of these things that are somewhat easy to solve if you can actually look at the data you're mm-hmm. storing in a conventional system that all of a sudden become difficult crypto problems.
Yeah, I agree. That's a great question. In fact, debugging in general is quite difficult, right? Because you're running an encrypted computation, you get the final result, you look at it and it's garbage. What happened? What happened where? Right? So the way you could do is you can add some checks in the secure computation at different steps, like debugging checks, and if anyone assertions, and if any one of them fails, you could be informed then. There might be a privacy leak by the fact that there's a failure at what point, but that's one thing you could do. But generally, I think that you're bringing up a great point that there isn't a lot of work in thinking of how to deal with operability, you know, debugging issues, and there should be more work in this space. Debugging encrypted computation, yeah.
Like, as an example of something mundane, imagine you write a sector to a drive and it loses the write. Now, how do you figure that out?
Yeah.
This as an example of just not even getting into enclaves, just writing this on top of boring hardware. It's even, you know, even up in like the chat or the mail sort of use cases, it gets tricky sometimes.
Yeah. So in terms of
application too.
Yeah. Exactly. So in terms of fault tolerance and application, that story remains largely unchanged. So for example, Opaque is on top of Spark SQL, which already replicates all of this computation. So you still use replication, right? So.
No, but with when you have when you're trying to hide patterns and you know and all of this, how do you do replication? It's not clear to me.
Yeah, you can still. So a lot of these oblivious algorithms that we design at least are deterministic access pattern, so that is easy to replicate. Oblivious RAM is randomized, yes. But for analytics, we're not doing oblivious RAM. We're doing just very well-defined sorting networks or scans or things very well predefined that are deterministic and you know, you can replicate them. But it's true that if you have an oblivious RAM scenario where it's more randomized, then maybe you might have to have the same randomness in the different clients so that they do the same thing, but it's unknown to the attacker what the randomness is.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.